Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, the podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on the help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry, but I had my mic muted.
That's why there's a slight pause.
It's all right, we'll edit that out and post.
So this is episode 40. Now, did you know actually that there's two temperatures on the scale where Fahrenheit and centigrade have the same number?
That's minus 40.
One of them's minus 40, and the other one is
40.
And that that's followed another silence as well. Well, if you call it a number, or you call it a description, infinity. 40 is also the highest number ever counted to on Sesame Street. I don't know if the count did that.
That must have been a long sketch.
It's the number of spaces on a Monopoly board. Yeah. Of course, they say life begins at 40, and you have 40 winks. 40 is the only integer whose English name has its letters in alphabetical order. Most people work a 40-hour week, and as we've just had, well, a little bit ago, we've just had Easter, then there's 40 days of Lent before Easter. And it's also the episode of this podcast. So we haven't been on for a little while. I haven't actually got that much to that much related or interest for this week. I've got a few things, but what's everybody else been up to?
I've been up to quite a bit. I've been on a training course for Office 365, which is quite interesting. So learned quite a bit about Office 365, but I mean, I knew most of it, kind of thing. Some of the people on the calls were actually quite struggling with it. By the end of the call, it's basically the last day I was really waiting for, because it's all about single sign-on and ADFS. But we'll probably go into another show on that. But no, it's a lot easier when you know kind of how it is. Wouldn't you have to get set up and play with it yourself? It's kind of it's really interesting how it all works. It basically means it's like with Office 365, when you sign in with your username and password, is normally you set them up, they're called cloud accounts, is the username and password you can log on with. And what you can also do is that you can also do a thing where you can sync your passwords up with your Active Directory, so that whatever you change your password up to directory, it will be synced up into Office 365. And then ADFS is basically the next step along, so that it basically gives you more features. You can have things like multi-factor authentication and stuff. But one of the things I did learn about it is was quite interesting. Is in a PowerShell about, because I always get confused about if you meant to have a single quotes and like the double speech marks, and I don't, or well, sorry, a single speech marks and a double speech mark, and I always wanted to know why was the difference. What are the differences?
I think we discussed this in the last show, and it turns out, I think from what we were saying, that if it's double quotes, then if you've got any variables inside those double quotes, it interprets them. Whereas if it's single quotes, it's literal. And that's exactly the same as Bash in Linux or Unix or whatever.
That was in the pub we were discussing that.
That's true, yeah. We should say for the listeners, we actually met up in real life.
Yeah.
And it wasn't Ogcamp, so we both happened to be in London. Well, I worked there and I was doing the training there, so we actually met up in real life again, which is nice.
And a nice pint of Punk IPA as well.
Yeah, it's good to find a pub that does Punk IPA on draft.
So yeah, that's what I said. So yeah, if it's a single quote, it will. What is it, if it's a single quote, does it say that
it's literal? So it's whatever's in the quotes is what ends up being input into whatever command you're doing.
Yeah.
And if it's double quotes and you've got a variable in there, then it will interpret the variable.
Yeah.
So for instance, if you like in Bash, you've got a dollar. Say dollar variable. So you've got double quotes. My name is dollar variable. Full stop. End double quotes. If you've defined that variable before, say variable equals Jerry, then it will say my name is Jerry. If that's in single quotes, it will just say my name is dollar variable. So hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, that's exactly the same thing. That's exactly the same how it worked with by putting a dollar in the front of it in PowerShell, that's the same thing.
Yeah. So,
which is good. So, Andy, what have you been up to?
Well, a couple of little things. I was at one of these big play places that you can take your kids to. You know, there's big slides and all that kind of stuff.
Soft play type places. And,
yeah. I just call them play places. I don't know
play places, yeah.
Yeah. So there's one of them by us. I've actually been there before, and they give me a call because what they do is one of the till systems actually has they can order, you know, you can go to the counter and order food, so you can eat something while they're all off playing or whatever. And what happens is when they send the food order, then it sends it to a printer out in the kitchen, and then that prints out sausage, egg and chips or whatever, you know. So the chef knows what he needs to do. So the problem that he had is it wasn't printing to that little printer. That's not a, it's not a big printer, an A4 printer. It's one of these little, it's like a till receipt printer, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm.
So I got there to have a look, and they showed me where the printer was. And that was way out the back. Now, that was plugged in on an Ethernet cable, which plugged into the wall. And the till that they had behind the counter, it was just a touchscreen. It was quite annoying, actually, because it was touchscreen. There wasn't a keyboard anywhere. So I had to use the onboard, no on-screen keyboard that you can have in Windows. Mm-hmm. I had to use that to get any kind of typing in. So when I went into the printer settings, there was two printers set up, one for the little printer next to it, which was for like till receipts and things like that for the customers, and the other till that was set up was for the kitchen. So I went into the printer properties to see if it could figure out where it was supposed to be sending it to, and it was just set up as LPT2 as the printer port for it. I thought, well, that can't be right, because I'm not going to send it on a LPT2.
That's a parallel port, isn't it?
On a parallel port, yeah. There was the local one was actually plugged into I don't know if it was a 9-pin parallel port or I think it was a 9-pin one in the back. But the one in the kitchen was an Ethernet one. So I thought, well, I was looking for an IP address, but I had no idea what IP address it was. So I used one of those land scan programs. I think I've mentioned it before. It's called NetScan or something like that. It's a free program you can download just to scan the IP range to see what IP addresses were on the system. So when I ran that through, there was probably about 20 or 25 IP addresses found between 0.1 and 0.254. So I thought, well, there was no indication on this list of what was what or anything like that. So I thought, initially thought, how the hell am I going to figure out what IP address the printer is, out of all these on the list? So then I just suddenly thought, well, hang on, on this land scan program, it actually tells you the IP address it's found, and it tells you the MAC address of that device that's on it. So I thought, well, that could be a clue. So I went into the kitchen and found this little printer again. And I looked on the bottom, and the MAC address of the printer was obviously printed on the bottom of the printer. I think it was 0026 something something. So I just went back to the list on the screen, and there it was. And I had an IP address of somebody have probably quite deliberately set it up as 0.100. Probably easy to remember if you know what it was. I didn't know what it was, you see, that was a problem. So obviously then I just went into the printer properties, set up a new port because the port wasn't there, TCP IP port, set it to 0.100, applied it, it found it straight away and printed it all back on again. So so the chef was actually made up with that. He thought it was amazing that I could turn up and fix it. And then the chef said, he said, I probably shouldn't say this, but the bosses were in here messing about with it yesterday, and ever since they left, this hasn't worked. So they've done something. I said, I don't know how they would have done it, why they would have specifically gone in and took an IP address off a printer. It's unlikely that someone's going to, you know, inadvertently do that. So I don't know what they've done. So that was one thing that that I've been up to. Another one now is, it's you may have an answer for this, or it may just be one of those things. But this again was to do with a printer on a network. So this computer had completely lost the connection to an IP printer. This is in a different location, this different place.
Yeah.
So I did the same with that. I went to the but on the computer, I just went to network to see if it could see any other devices on the network, like the printers and that, and the other PC names. And there's nothing on the list whatsoever. So that's her. So I again use that LandScan program. It's really bizarre, and I've had this before. When you run LandScan on this one computer, it only found its computer, the one it was, yeah, and the gateway. None of the others, just that computer and the gateway. And because of this has happened before, the first thing I did when I got when I got 2 seconds with everyone else using it, was reboot the router. After I rebooted the router, I could then see everything. So I mean, I've had that before, but I don't know why, or is it just one of those things that all the other computers could see every other machine on the network, it could see every printer on the network. It was just this one machine that couldn't see anything, but by rebooting the router, it fixed it all.
Mm-hmm.
Have you come across that before, or do you know why that happens? Or because it's a bit bizarre to me. it's one of those. You see, when it's only one machine that's not connecting, you think the problem's in that computer itself. But for some bizarre reason, rebooting the router fixes the whole thing. So I don't know quite why it's doing that. So there was another thing as well I was going to think of.
To be honest, that sounds like a dodgy router to me, because the router is also the network hub for the network in a lot of cases, or the equivalent of a switch. So if it's dodgy or not working properly, then that would be the reason. Actually, what it could be is the ARP table. Al, do you think that's what it could be?
Could be. So what was it? Just go through the problem again then. What was it? The PCs couldn't see the printer or anything? Or
okay, so in this little office, it's like a state agent's, basically. There's 5 computers and 2 network printers, right? So they've all got their own IP address. So the problem that they had when they called me up is this one computer could not print. So when I got there to have a look at it, that one computer, it could not print to any of the network printers whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So when it went into you know, your network sharing center,
yeah,
in Windows 7, or even if you just go, you know, my computer, and then pick network from the list on the side, it would normally pick up every computer that it could find on the Windows network, couldn't it? All the PC names.
Yeah.
All it could find was the name of itself.
Yeah.
And the name of the router. It was a BT hub. That's all it could find. All the other computers in the place could see everything, and nothing was a problem. It's just with one machine. So, and obviously it couldn't see the printer.
Mm-hmm.
I then run NetScan, LANscan, to see what IP addresses it could find, and it couldn't find any other IP address. The only IP address it picked up was its own IP address, which was 1.68 or something like that, and the BT hub, which is 1.254. That's all that one PC could pick up.
Mm-hmm.
So as I've seen this before, I wasn't going to waste my time trying to fix things on the computer. It went straight to the BT hub, turned it off, turned it back on again, and let it boot up. When it rebooted, went back to the problematic PC, went back to my computer network, it could see every machine, every printer on the system, and everything worked again straight away.
Yeah, that sounds Arctable related to me, actually.
Yeah, I'd say Arctable. The same thing, yeah.
If it was fixed by rebooting the router, then yeah.
Yeah.
Because what the Arctable does is map the MAC address to the IP address.
Okay.
And if that's screwy, then, you know, you can ping something and it'll kind of say, right, this packet's coming from here and it wants to know where this other PC is. Now, what does that IP, that MAC address, what does that IP map to? Which MAC address does this IP map to? And if it
okay.
and if it hasn't got anything there, it'll just kind of fail silently, effectively. It won't give you a particularly good error or anything. So,
yeah.
And so that's how switches work. I mean, in the old days, you used to have hubs, and they would just broadcast to every port, and it would just pick up the device that needed the packet would respond to the broadcast. But the way switches work is they keep a record of which port has which MAC address. So that way, okay. they're more efficient at packet switching, but sometimes you get this behaviour. And to be honest, it doesn't surprise me that BT Home Hub is not very good at it, because they've got a reputation of not being particularly good routers.
Well, they're not the best bits of kit, are they?
No.
People say to me, oh, I've got this router for free, you know, and I'm saying to people, oh, you should buy this or get this, and they said, oh, we'll just get one for free from them, you know, but they're crap, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's the relation then between that IP address and the MAC address. Mm. That's what ties them both together.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, yeah. There's something screwed up in the router in the Arctable, so...
Yeah.
So basically, obviously, if you keep an eye or the he gives me a bell back again and says, "Hang on, this isn't working again," then it's likely to say, "Right, you need to get a new router."
Yeah.
So,
you could get a switch and plug that into the router and plug all your computers into the switch.
Okay. Yeah.
As long as it's a fairly decent switch.
Yeah. So they're two of the things that's been going on. Another thing, actually, I'll leave this next one till next time, because I've got to figure out there's a bit of a story behind it. It's actually to do with, remember several episodes ago, I don't know what number it was, when we were talking about VLANs, and you know that Draytech router in the Draytech?
Yeah.
Access point
mm-hmm.
that the guy got, and we set it all up and we did the VLANs and all that kind of stuff, and the It's all to do with that. And a complete and utter... I don't know how I can describe it without using some different wording. Mess up by by some people that he knows who took it upon themselves to completely change what we, you know, what we talked about and what we'd done, completely change all of that because of some other reason, which didn't take into account any of the, the isolation that you get between the different VLANs. So the public, this is where they had the public Wi-Fi, couldn't access the TILs and that on a different IP range. They didn't take that into account one bit, and basically told the owner that the person who set this up didn't know what he was doing. Because it gets complicated, this. Because the internet was going slow, this is why they changed it all. And he told the owner the person who set it up didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
And then because that then the guy phoned me up and said the internet wasn't working. And he asked me to go, but this is where it's very complicated. A lot of this stuff I found out later, but I didn't know at the time. That these people had completely messed it up. And then eventually by telling the owner what had happened, then I had to do it all again from scratch. But actually not from scratch, because luckily I'd saved the configuration files from when we first did it. So I just had to reload the configuration files and it was practically all done then. But there's a bit more to it than that, so I'll come back to that in another show. I've just remembered it now, and so I'll have a think about how I can say it in the actual order that I learnt it all. But so other than that, that's all I've been up to since the last episode. So that's that. So what were you going to talk about, Jerry? Then.
Well, I've just been doing more stuff at my day job, which is actually, getting my attention and being interesting, unlike my last day job. So that's been good. I mean, the main thing that I've taken away from it, there's quite a lot of stuff that's happened in between this podcast and the last podcast. So I can't point to any particular things, but the one thing that stuck out kind of thing is, I don't really like the word DevOps because it just means really what Linux admins have been doing for years. Anyway, that's a different story. But one of the things I came across was this notion of servers as cattle versus pets. So if you have a server that you look after, then you tend to make lots of little changes on that server, and you may document them or you may not document them. Well, part of the sort of DevOps, in air quotes, workflow is to configure everything. So write code to configure those servers. So anyone that listens to this podcast will know that I love Ansible, and Ansible is really good for that kind of thing. Turns out the way that I've been using Ansible isn't really in that way. It's just to kind of save me some typing. But it's possible to write code to configure a whole infrastructure that way. Mm-hmm. And this sort of cattle versus pets argument says that your servers should treat them like cattle. You shouldn't be attached to them. They should be able to go away and come back. And your setup should be resilient enough to cope with that. So in AWS, you have this notion of auto-scaling groups that can start up or any of the servers in them can shut down or start up at any time, according to something you define, like, you know, if the CPU is over a certain amount for a certain amount of time, then start up another instance. But you can also use this to roll in and out instances, as in servers, as you see fit. And the servers, when the new servers come online, they should be already configured, fully configured, and then they should start doing what they're supposed to do, like serving web pages or being a database, you know, serving data from a database or that sort of thing. So one of the things that I do now when I build a server is make sure, if I make any modifications on the server, I make sure that I rebuild that server, as long as it's not something that's live. I haven't quite got to that stage yet. And when it rebuilds, it should come up in a state ready to do what it's supposed to do. So, yeah, kind of been looking into that. It kind of leads on to a notion of immutable infrastructure. So if you have a web server, it's a web server, and that's what it does, and it serves web pages. Anything that it any kind of log files or whatever like that, it writes to a separate something that collects the log files. So essentially, nothing's getting written to the disk. It's just serving web pages in the case of a web server.
Like Elastic. Something like Elastic Log or Logstash or something.
Logstash. That's. I haven't actually looked into that. We're using a service called PaperTrail, which you just configure the logging software in Linux to send it to this particular address. So nothing gets written to the server. You have to do work. You know, you have to configure the log to do that, but you do that. The idea is you do that at boot time. And in the context of AWS, you can use that to basically, you make a change on the server and you kind of use Git or whatever to commit that. And then the idea is that you use these continuous integration tools that the developers use to build an image, test the image. So you've got to write the tests for the image to make sure it does what it's supposed to do. And then you keep that image, and the idea is that you can replace the servers on a daily basis with this updated image. So that's the kind of end goal, maybe. it has advantages in terms of your infrastructure is in a known state and it doesn't drift. So you know that if a developer comes to you with a problem, then it's not the fault of your infrastructure, because you know the state of your infrastructure at any single point. And that has advantages for security and so on. You know, you can always deploy an image with the latest patches, software patches and so on, or if there's an update, you can just build an image. And then that has advantages when you want to scale. So in AWS, you can have auto-scaling groups where, as I just described, you know, they can increase or decrease. And if you always know that the latest image with all the fixes you put in is going to be fired up, then that's an advantage. So, yeah. So that's the sort of insight I've had over the past few weeks.
Are you using Elastic Beanstalk then?
No, I haven't actually used that. I don't actually know what it does. It's one of those things with a cryptic name in AWS that you can't really tell what it does. So what's that do then?
I don't know. It's a buzzword. Right. It's a buzzword from...
Yeah.
I'm actually going on an AWS course at the end of the month.
Really?
Yeah. One of our customers uses it and they want us to help them out a bit more. And I've done a bit in the past and they want some more help doing it. So I'm going on the course.
Cool.
Yeah, 3-day course, none of it's quite good. I hope I'll learn a bit more. I better come back. And they were talking all about the things, about what they use inside their things, like their back end. They use database servers, what Amazon kind of uses.
Okay. So that's probably RDS, the sort of Amazon managed database service.
I was going to ask you, because I was in the meeting, they're talking about storybooks. Is that something you were going on about the other day?
I've not heard of storybooks, but...
That might not be the right word, but, like, you have a...
User stories or that sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't know. Do you use something at your work where, you have a plan of action and what you're going to do for the next 2 weeks?
Yeah, and then that's Agile... it's the first company I've worked at that does that, but everything is based around the user, so they have user stories, which I guess is just like a ticket, in a ticketing system, if you like, but it's all from the user's point of view. I think that's the idea anyway.
Yeah, because they use it. Cause I'm guessing that they have a target for every 2 weeks. They have so many things they've got to do, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a sprint. So at the beginning of the 2 weeks, you plan what you're going to do, and then you try and get it done in those 2 weeks.
Yeah, and then if you find something else out, and then the next 2 weeks, you then sit down with the people in your team and you work out what you're going to do in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah, so it seems like quite a good way of working. And also, another important thing is, do you have a stand-up meeting every morning? So you say what you did yesterday and what you can do today.
All right.
I mean, I think some places do that multiple times a day, but that seems like a bit of a...
Do you have to stand up and tell everybody?
Well, no, you'll stand around in a circle. I just talk about what you did yesterday and what you can do today.
Yeah.
And then people can comment on that or whatever and...
Yeah, because I managed to set myself an AWS account up for free, because apparently you can have a free account for a year if you don't go over a certain amount of money or whatever.
Yeah.
So I managed to set one up, got a load balancer working, and so it's quite interesting.
Yeah, no, it's worth doing. I did that, but I was scared that I was going to start costing myself money. But now I've got a whole, someone else's account to play with, it's fine. Can experiment to my heart's content.
Yeah, cool. Something else I learned today as well is, Andy, can you press the Windows key and the pause key on your keyboard?
At the same time?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. It brings up the system properties.
Oh, right.
It only works on a... I can't do it on my machine, I'm on a Linux machine, but on a Windows machine, if you press Windows break, it brings up the computer management screen, or the computer property, so you can do things like change your computer name and stuff. It's handy.
Know what the kids say to all the other kids who don't know about computers? They say, "Oh, in order to fix that, you press Alt F4, that fixes it." Works every time.
Usually, so, if you press it enough times,
that's a good one. That Windows.
So
yeah. So what was that? Windows pause.
Yeah.
Excellent. I have to remember that. Yeah. I like keyboard shortcuts. I try and use the keyboard as much as possible.
And another thing I found out the other day is, everybody heard me talk about mxtoolbox.com before, where you can do things like,
oh yeah,
you put in the your domain name and it comes back with your what a DNS service. I found out about that. They actually provide an email header decoder. So if you got an email and you want to look at the headers, you want to know where it came from, whatever, what server it came from and everything, what the X headers on it, you basically go, I'll put the link in the show notes, basically you click on it, you go to this website and you basically copy and paste in the email header into this website, and it will basically decode it for you, so you haven't got to search for it, and it will tell you all the information about that email.
Oh, nice.
Oh, that's good. We're talking about that. Was it the last episode we're talking about that with, faking your email address and all that lot? Mm. Yeah. That's good, Oh, I've never used it for that, but that's good.
So is that on MX Toolbox where you can do that?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, yeah, I think the email header analyzer, yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, also, I had a couple of issues with our web server. I'm actually maybe looking at changing it to FreeBSD. I'm really kind of interested in FreeBSD, listening to Alan Jude and the different podcasts. It just seems to be... their documentation is really good, though, for FreeBSD. For someone like me, it's just so easy to go there. You read it. It's just such plain English. Kind of tells you what you can go through different stages. Like, I read about how you can set up the server from scratch, and it just seems to be really easy to follow kind of thing. So I'll probably tell a bit more about that in the future when I hopefully maybe get things going over to it. I mean, because looking at running Nginx on it rather than running at Apache, because it's meant to be more RAM, it's meant to be more memory efficient than what Apache is.
So. Yeah, I'm actually using Nginx on my new server, so we'll see how it goes.
Because I wanted to look at, because you have blocks, don't you, instead of virtual hosts.
Well, it's effectively the same thing. The configuration is slightly different, but I think it's just supposed to be faster.
Because I had a problem where, because I think with Apache, every time someone connects to your website, web server, it launches a new Apache, doesn't it?
You can configure that, I think, but maybe it's just easier in Nginx. I mean, a lot of people that just want fast websites.
Yeah,
and kind of optimize all that.
Because I had someone kind of like hack, or not hack, or try a DDoS our website, because they were just pulling. So it basically went offline, and I couldn't work out why. As soon as I stopped the Apache service, it was fine. And if I did an IP show of all the IP connections, you could see there was two IP addresses from somewhere, like connecting over 100 times to each of the service. Kind of thing. So what I managed to do is, apparently you can null route the IP addresses quickly to stop them to kind of like, so they can't connect kind of thing. So if you null route them to your loopback address, the packet will receive, but they can't send them back. So that was quite interesting. If that makes sense, Andy.
Yeah, I think so. So they were trying to ping it, do you mean?
Well, they're just basically just trying to open up the web page over and over and over and over and over again, like with new sessions kind of thing. So I just looked at what IP address. Instead of blocking it on the firewall quickly, you can just do a root add, and you can basically tell it to route it back to itself, so that any packet gets it just drops it. But I also worked out that I'm thinking, basically every time that they would do this new session, it was basically generating a load of Apaches, and that was just killing my web server. So what you can do is, in Apache, you can limit how many connections per IP address. I'm thinking, well, there's no more than 10 people going to try and connect to my one IP address at the same time, really. It's not like I'm running a massive web server. And we haven't got that many and so many thousands of listeners, are we? So I limited it to 10, restarted Apache, and my Apache server's been fine since then.
Yeah, nice.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's for simultaneous connections, is it?
Yeah, I think there's people are trying to flood it to take it down, like a mini DDoS attack against it. So. Do you hear about Steve Gibson with his attack? They kept trying to take his website down, didn't they?
Yeah, well, they succeeded, didn't they? It was like, it was down on one episode, and then it was back up, and it went down during the episode.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think he's weathered it all right. I think that whoever was doing it got bored.
The other thing I was going to say about that, interesting, I was going to talk about was that I don't know if you had in the past of Windows, if you got remote users who never really come into the office and connect to the domain properly, their passwords can sometimes expire. And the only time in Windows really is that is that it only warns you you're password expiring if you log in every day. So if you're on a connected network in the office and then you connect to a domain controller, it will then warn you once you log in. But if you're on the road warrior or something or working away from the office soon, when you log onto the computer, it doesn't display that message. So you can get a problem where then your password expires after, if you know what I mean. So if you try and VPN in and your password expired, you obviously can't connect to the network because your password expired.
Yeah, I've had that when, you know, with my old job, you know, we had Windows laptops and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you could be on holiday for a couple of weeks and then come back and nothing works. Yeah, if you need to log on, like you say, on a VPN, then you're out of luck, really.
Mm-hmm. So there's basically a Fanner script, which is just on Microsoft, where basically you run it every day, and it basically looks at the people's, you run it on your domain controller, and it basically emails the users when their password expires. So they get every day, they get an email saying how many days their password will expire. So they will get, at least they will get a notification of when their password will expire, if you see what I mean. So you can basically configure it. You say, like, if your password expires in 10 days, please, it will start emailing you every day. So every day, say 10 days, your password expires in 10 days, and the next day, 9. So these have actually got a notification, because at least if they can connect to the network, connect to VPN, press crawl or delete, and then change their password, then the problem won't exist, because they obviously changed the password before the day they will get it done with. So, yes. So, have you got anything else to talk about, Jerry?
There was one thing I was going to... I always, on these podcasts, I always say that I'm going to follow up on something later. One of the things that I'm going to follow up on next time is I'm going to say live on air that I'm going to learn some Python by the time we're doing the next podcast. And that's because some of the stuff I've been dealing with over the past few weeks has been Python scripts and what they're doing and why they're not working. And I've had a bit of guidance of this guy, this DevOps guy that taught me the stuff at the current job. So I've seen a few tutorials online. One of the ones that caught my eye was Automate the Boring Stuff with Python, which sounded good. And it looked pretty good as well. So hopefully, I mean, I don't know when the next podcast is going to be out, but by then I will have some Python under my belt. Something else I came up against recently was... I use a Mac laptop, and some of the commands are subtly different. So, like the sed command, sed is a stream editor. So, basically, use it. I mean, you can think of it. One of the uses is to search and replace in lots of files at the same time with one command, or you know, just search and replace in one file. So sed wasn't working the way I expected it to, so I used a Vagrant box, which I've talked about before. It wraps VirtualBox, so it's really easy to just get a VirtualBox up on your Mac or PC or whatever. And that had the version of sed that did what I expected, so my little sed one-liner worked on Linux on my Mac rather than actually on my Mac itself. So
yeah,
a little hint there. And kind of linked to that is again, it's news now, but it may not be news when the podcast comes out. But the next version of Windows 10 apparently will include kind of Linux user land by default, which is pretty interesting, I think. And you'll be able to use Bash and your favourite editor, so hopefully Vim will be on there, Emacs and so on, from within Windows. So there's been quite a bit of discussion about this. I heard about it on the Linux Action Show, but I think Linux Luddites covered it as well. So probably go and listen to them for a bit more in-depth analysis. But I think it's going to be interesting anyway.
Yeah, it means you should be able to basically just like change into a terminal, basically, can't you?
Yeah.
And you can start running your and doing stuff with Linux commands in Windows.
I mean, I don't know how many times I've opened up a command prompt and typed ls, and nothing's happened.
I do it all the time now. It's because I just command line so much these days. You get into it. It's like, interesting. Today I had a problem where one of my customers they've got two of these Linux boxes running Debian as their firewalls. I think they must be like little busy boxes or something, like little Celeron boxes with like six network connections on each of them, kind of thing, with like a gig of RAM in it or something.
Yeah.
So,
you got in touch with me today about this, didn't you?
Yeah. I managed to figure it out myself in the end, but their VPN connection had gone between the two. And they're not running, annoyingly, they're not running IP tables on it. They're running something else, like, I can't remember what it's called now, but it's something. So they're basically running Debian, and then on top of that, they're then running another firewall, which isn't IP tables.
Right.
And the documentation doesn't seem to be that, well, it does seem to be great, but it doesn't seem to, it's really hard to learn something in production, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Without breaking anything. So,
you want to have test environments there first.
Yeah. Well, anyway, they're using OpenSwan for their VPN, and I worked out that it was OpenSwan doing their IPsec VPN. But then whenever I tried to run a command, like looking at the status of the IP, like you can run service, I think it's IPsec status, it wouldn't return anything. It said like the command wasn't found. But then I realised that the account I've been given to log onto this firewall didn't have sudo rights or anything. It didn't even have sudo installed on it. So then we hadn't been given the root password. So I wasn't logged on as root, and that's why I couldn't do half the things.
Okay.
So
sometimes if the binaries are in /sbin, you can run it as a non-root user, but you have to do sbin /, and then the command.
Yeah.
Because it's not in the path for the non-root user, but it's like ifconfig, I think, will only work for root because it's in the path, but you can run /sbin/ifconfig
mm-hmm.
as a non-root user.
Yeah,
obviously you won't be able to change anything unless you're root.
No. So I could basically just, because I was just happily just kind of browsing around the file system going, yeah, I can find the files, but it was just really odd that this and the thing I couldn't work out is that it was hard because I could run one command on one thing, then I was basically working out, I was running an IPsec command. I was just having a look if I can find the command now. But I was going to ask you, where can you go to get help about these commands? Because I wanted to run, I could see there's people, I ran a command which basically said, service IPsec /status, and it basically come back saying how many tunnels were up. And one of the ones said it had four tunnels up, okay. But I wanted to know what those tunnels were up, if you know what I mean. I wanted to know what those tunnels were. And I couldn't find a command that told you what those tunnels were. So I could see there's a command you could run IPsec /autos/status, it would tell you what kind of a bit of like a log thing, but it was just really hard to read kind of thing. So I was wondering where you could go to help to kind of like ask, and I was Googling it. I was thinking, well, someone must be the same sort of thing. But in the end, I basically had to just stop and start the services on both ends, and it basically brought it up kind of thing. So
yeah, I mean, I've never used IPsec, I have to admit, so I'm not sure. But
where would you go to kind of find out? Would you have to go to a mailing list or something, or IRC chat thing?
Did you try the man page of IPsec?
Yeah, but I did the main man page, but didn't I didn't find it that helpful, kind of thing. Because I found the man page from linux.di.net. What is that?
Yeah.
Basically, it's the man page.
Yeah, it's just like a catalogue of man pages there, yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of made sense. But there's something you want to speak to someone who knows what it's doing, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Sometimes it's just hard to kind of read it, if you know what I mean.
I've heard that.
It's basically saying, like.
Sorry, after you.
Okay, so you reckon our IRC might be?
Yeah, well, I've never been a big IRC user. I barely log on to IRC, which I've heard is a good place to get help because, yeah, just people who are in there that will know how to help you. But I always end up either mailing list or most of the time just a web page, which. Where someone's come across the same problem. that's how I've kind of done my IT career.
The way I was meant to do it, because the way I wanted to do it, because I wanted to basically just tear that, because I kind of, I don't know, ASA or whatever, you can basically right click or in the Virgo, you can click on the tunnel and say disconnect on both ends, and then you can, or you can say tear it down. But I couldn't work out. Apparently, you can do IPsec auto, and then what are the two little minus signs? And then there, but minus sign, and you can say like Dan, and the name of the tunnel, which is configured in the config. But it just wouldn't work. So I wanted to just, if it happens again in the future, I wanted to know that how I could kind of how I could. Work out kind of thing, so that's maybe I have to go and check on an IRC channel.
Yeah, IRC or just reading articles or whatever. That's normally how I solve things, and then I forget to document how I did it. So the next time I come to it, I haven't got a clue. Well, I've got a clue, but I don't know exactly how. That's obviously, listeners, that's not the way to go. You should make good documentation and notes. That's how you.
Yeah, I made a documentation how to do it. Also, I like a good documentation as well. But I also like, I love in Chrome, you can just print to a PDF directly. So if I come across a good website with a good blog, I like to put it into a PDF format and then save it onto my Dropbox because it might not be there next time I want to do it, kind of thing.
It's a good idea.
So, do we have a. We had an email come in, didn't we? From the last. We might have forgotten about it.
Yeah, we got an email. Yeah. Right, let's just bring it up here. Right, this is from John. I don't know where John's from, but it's referring back to episode 37 a few episodes ago. So he says, hello, I was listening to podcast number 37. And heard mentioned that somebody had HP BIOS that is locked. I had the same issue when a used laptop I bought and tried the rescue tools to unlock the password. I tried the master password, but nothing worked. In the end, I started a trouble ticket with HP, and even though the warranty was expired, they created a file based on the UUID to reset the password. There are a few steps needed to get the BIOS flashed, but it worked. Hope this helps, and that's from John. Did you know where John was from? Or
don't think they know.
No. So that was a few episodes ago, wasn't it? We were talking about that, but it's an idea, isn't it? Even though the warranty's expired, it still sounds like that they helped him with that. So that was good. Do you remember what that was? What we were talking about with that one?
I think it's I had a laptop, but we couldn't get it. Basically, I couldn't get into the BIOS to change the settings to say boot from the USB disk or anything like that. It was an HP.
Ah, right.
But I basically managed to, because it's Linux SSD, I basically put it onto, built it on one machine and then basically moved the SSD into.
I remember, yeah. Loaded it and moved the hard disk from one to the other, yeah.
Another thing I found is Scrapyard Wars on YouTube. It's basically these people who run this YouTube channel, and they go around having challenges to see what PC they can build with the most least money. So they get given like, I don't know, $300 or whatever, and they have to build the most best gaming PC they can build with the money. So I'll put a link into the show notes to that.
Yeah, and also, like Scrap Heap Challenge. But
yeah, well, that's what I heard. The guy tweeted it because I basically, I don't know why, how I managed to stumble across his site on his YouTube channel, so I subscribed to it. And he was tweeting it. And I thought, like, oh, wow, there's a new season of Scrap Heap Challenge. I used to love that program when I was a kid. And then, yeah, it wasn't it was at all. It was them doing that. So and the other thing as well, you know, you talk about Serial ages ago, about the Serial podcast.
Oh, yeah, Serial. Yes. Again, I think I thought you meant Serial Port. I was because we were talking about Serial Port today, weren't
yeah.
we?
But. Yeah. They had another thing. They've basically had a second series now, haven't they?
It's about this soldier that walks off his base in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And his story and his story of all the other people that got affected by it, yeah.
But the other one is that they've basically done some recaps. I've done 3 episodes from the first series, apparently, as well.
Right, yeah. I did hear about that. I didn't hear the updates or anything.
No.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, what happened? I've actually got a VM which is running some applications, which we don't know what the root password is. Is it the best way of just basically booting off a Linux CD and then just changing the file, the root file or something?
If it's not encrypted, then you should be able to boot off a boot CD. But one of the things I was going to suggest today, actually, when you were talking about trying to get into a Debian box, was you can interrupt the boot sequence and tell it to boot in single user.
Yep.
And then from there you can change the root password. Okay. And then boot it up normally and you'll know the root password.
So, what do you think about changing a root password? Do you think it will break anything or not?
No, I don't think so.
All right, because normally, like as a Windows box, if you change administrator password, it can break loads of things. Because like if you've got services running under that account and stuff, it can break stuff.
Okay.
But I'm guessing in Linux, it doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah, no, password's purely for just logging in. So, all right. And anything else, will you be using other kind of? If it needs to authenticate, or usually have its own logic, it's not so closely tied to the system in that sense a lot of the time.
Cool. Yeah. Okay, well, I haven't got anything else more to bring to the show tonight.
One thing I was going to mention was about Postgres, the database system that I've just come across. I'll put a link in the show notes, but there's a lot of things you can do with it. There's a lot of extensions, and you can do things there's a thing called PostGIS, so mm-hmm. PostGIS, and it uses a database in such a way that spatial coordinates make sense. So you can, like, for instance, if you've got 2 spatial coordinates, you can find the distance between them, and that sort of thing, all through the database. And other things that will do things like image processing, like say you effectively can upload an image to the database and then tell it to crop it, resize it, rotate it, or whatever, or resize it, or whatever. And this is just a function of the database. So probably something I'll look at as I go down this kind of DevOpsy route. But yeah, it does sound quite interesting. So I'll just sort of flag that up. I'll put a link in the show notes and people can look at it if they're interested.
Cool. Good. You got anything else to say, Andy?
No, that's it for this week. I'll bring some more stuff up next time.
Cool. All right. We'll all speak to you all soon. And you can email us at mail@admabinpodcast.co.uk if you want to...
Find us on social media as well.
Yeah.
And hopefully it won't be so long until the next podcast, but until then.
Yes. Right, speak to you all soon. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, all right, see you now.
and we're so